This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. A Hawaii man living in a housing complex for low-income seniors is again challenging what rights a Section 8 tenant actually has. Section 8 tenants rely on federal HUD funding to subsidize the difference of what they can pay toward their monthly rent and the total cost. This month, a federal judge revivified the case of Lanrick Highland by overturning a portion of the magistrate's order a year ago. Mr. Highland had previously tried to sue Hawaii Affordable Properties, the real estate management company for Aina Kea Senior Residences in Kapa'au, where he lives, plus a county contractor and the County Office of Housing and Community Development. We called Victor Gemignani of the public interest nonprofit Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice, and we talked about what makes the Highland case extraordinary.
There are a number of things. Number one, it's a highly complex area, and the rights that this person might be denied, the tenant might be denied, i.e. exclusion from Section 8-based housing, is significant to his life. If he loses that right to Section 8, his life is going to change because he's going to have to go out and find marketplace housing. And with Section 8, you're pretty much guaranteed, as long as you follow the rules and regulations, you're guaranteed to have that benefit life. So it's the courage that he showed to really fight the system, I think, was kind of admirable. Number two, he chose to do it by himself because he couldn't find a lawyer to represent him, I presume. And therefore, he did, in the law, what we call pro se representation, representing yourself. And he filed in state court, and then the county made a decision to remove this case to federal court, which made it much more difficult, obviously, because of the complexity of federal rules and regulations and practices and court procedures, to continue to litigate by himself on a pro se basis. So those two things I found very interesting. I also found very interesting that Judge Leslie Kobayashi in federal court, who I have a great deal of respect for, overruled her magistrate when her magistrate was ready to dismiss the case for not having a cause of action that was litigatable.
Why do you think that she overturns that part of it?
Well, I'll go out on a limb here and tell you I think he has a clear right to have his argument about an ADA, Americans with Disability, reasonable accommodations, decided appropriately, not just rejected by the landlord. So I think he had a right to enforce that, and the judge basically agreed that he had a right to enforce that. And therefore, regardless of whether he was doing it pro se and regardless of whether he was arguing that he had a right to do a number of other things, i.e. create a tenants association out there is one of the things he was claiming. He did have a basic core right to have reasonable accommodations. Discussions ensued when they tried to restrict his ability to exercise his medical options for his health.
He now has an attorney and apparently has until the end of the month to be able to file an amended complaint. What do you think might be part of that, given that we've already, you know, heard the story and what his complaint really is?
Well, I would suspect the core of the argument is the one I just made, that he may have argued a series of other things. He argued he had a right to a grievance before the rules were put in place. He argued he had a right to create a tenants association without retaliation. All arguments, I think, which I could make good arguments he has the right to do, but they're weaker in terms of his clear right. But one thing he has a clear right to is protections under the American Disability Act. And if he can show that he's disabled and he can show that he has a medical need for a certain type of treatment, and that's doctor's testimony, obviously, and he can show that he's ready to make a reasonable accommodation, and that's where the crux is. What is a reasonable accommodation in this situation? If he's willing to do all of those things, it ought to go to the full procedure and have the discussion and then make a decision whether they're going to allow a reasonable accommodation that he's requested or not. So I think that probably will be a lot of what the amended complaint will be about, his core rights under federal law to enforce his protections that the Americans with Disability Act gives him.
The issue, though, of what a tenant in public housing has a right to do seems to also be really core to this whole case. Are you disadvantaged because you are low income and you're in public housing to be able to do some things that perhaps other tenants in other properties would be able to do?
Sure. Let me just state this is a highly complex area because there's different types of public housing and there are different rights that go along with different levels of public housing. For example, in the KPTs and the Mayor Rights, where the state owns the housing, you have significant rights to form tenant associations. In fact, the Housing Authority has an obligation to assist you in creating a tenants association so you have a vehicle to talk through. You have every right to ask for a series of grievance hearings on virtually anything that you think is being done inappropriately for you. Those kinds of rights do not necessarily exist clearly in federal law on project-based Section 8 or tenant-based Section 8, Section 8 programs, which are different completely than state-owned public housing.
So, Victor, is that part of the confusion then, and should it be made more consistent?
It's up to the government to decide, HUD to decide. I don't think under the current leadership in HUD they really care much about this, to be frank with you. Under Trump's appointee to run HUD, I don't think this is ever going to be an issue. They're moving in pretty much the opposite direction, I believe. But to answer your question, yeah, you have a lot of rights depending upon what your level of project aid is. And you have a right to a grievance, actually, in some situations in Section 8 public housing if they want to take your benefits away from you. The thing I want to drive home, people that are on Section 8 housing are very low income. And you're talking about moms with kids struggling, working one, two jobs, trying to find some accommodatable place that can actually afford a high cost of living area. That's a very, very, very important benefit because you pay no more than one-third of your income for your rent and utility costs. It's subsidized by the government. You cannot lose that benefit without being on the streets and homeless, unless or moving in with relatives and doubling up somewhere, because the marketplace just does not accommodate vast numbers of people, as we well know, that don't have subsidies from the government to afford rentals. They don't have them in the state, and that's our crux of our affordable housing crisis. So for Section 8 or public housing tenants, they really have to be extremely aware when the administration is doing anything that may conflict with their long-term rights to preserve their Section 8 housing. Because once you lose it for life. You will never get it back. That's part of the law. If they have to evict you for something, you will never get it back.
And
someone
that's the
rub. Is low income probably can't find representation to represent them in landlord-tenant court. And I could talk for hours about how badly only 4% of tenants are represented in landlord-tenant court. 70% of landlords are. So you're way outgunned in landlord-tenant court. So the bottom line is it takes a real courageous person to say, no, you're treating me wrong, and go through a grievance and worry, obviously, about the retaliation of the management for exercising those rights. And then not to be able to find legal representation to help you is just, you know, the coup de grace in terms of the dilemma you're faced with.
Luckily for this man, he has found legal representation. And in moving this case forward, what do you think this might mean for others who might have felt similarly disadvantaged or who felt that they made a trade-off for their family, not really understanding what that could mean long-term if they have a grievance?
Well, this man is very lucky to find a lawyer. I do not know this woman. I understand she's a political woman, has run for office, and cares very much about
she's a former councilwoman.
Exactly. To be frank with you, I think one of two things happened. Either Judge Kobayashi decided that this man needed some form of representation, and she made a couple of calls around to the Bar Association or the people in Hilo that she may have known, saying, somebody has to step up. Please do that. That happens sometimes when a judge really wants to exercise their right to do that, and they do have that. In the old days, that's how these cases were handled, with a judge saying, calling up someone in the bar saying, this is your pro bono case for the year. The other way it could have happened is it made publicity in the paper in a couple of different times, and that publicity may ultimately have brought the case to this woman's attention that ultimately is taking the case on. I admire her very much for doing that. Those pro bono opportunities are few and far between when you get into complex areas of law, much less when you get into simple areas just representing yourself in landlord-tenant court. There are no pro bono lawyers doing that for all intents and purposes. So to take it up to another level in a complex proceeding, it's even going to be harder to get a lawyer to dedicate all of the time and money they're going to have to dedicate since you can't pay them in the representation. So I admire this woman. I admire this tenant quite a lot, not necessarily on the backstory about what's really going on in their lives, but in terms of what they've taken on. I think it's wonderful example for all of us.
And we'll see how that all shakes out as this case continues on. Thanks so much for the time today.
Oh, very much my pleasure. You take care. Bye-bye.
Victor Geminani is the co-executive director of Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. He is not involved with the Highland case.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the seductive polyrhythms of South and West Africa. But first, your quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, ihau ukaua uahu umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolave uhawaiti.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about an artist who had a lasting impression on the arts in Hawaii. He was born in Paris in 1898 to what he described as a sundry exotic ancestors. He was educated at the Lycée Condorcet, where he won French National Scholastic Boxing Championships in 1912, and the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. He also drew much of his inspiration from the folk art he saw on his travels. He moved to Mexico and worked with muralist Diego Rivera in the 1920s and came to Hawaii in 1949 to paint a fresco at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. That was a 10 by 29 foot mural called Relation of Man and Nature in Old Hawaii in the administration building, Bachman Hall. Hawaii became the artist's home and the source of his inspiration for the rest of his life. He learned the Hawaiian language and spent the remaining 30 years of his life creating paintings, prints, and public art in the islands. He even became a playwright. And today we're looking for the name of this versatile artist. If you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one with the correct answer gets our reusable tote bag that tells everyone you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Gavin Swain from HMSA, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Music and dance are inseparable in Africa, and no one is expected to sit still when the music starts. It makes you wonder how music and dance got separated in the European traditions. Jamarek is a local band that celebrates the union of music and dance with its potent combination of South and West African and even Latin influences. Kapono Chiati is the musical director and Con McKay the lead vocalist for Jamarek, which performs in our Atherton studio this Saturday, and they're with us in our studio today. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Aloha. Great to be here.
Kapono, let's start with the rhythm, because everything starts with the rhythm, right?
It does.
And you brought a djembe drum with you today?
I did. It's a djembe drum straight from Mali in West Africa. And it is pretty much our go-to drum for Jamarek and our polyrhythmic music.
It's a hand drum.
Yeah, it is.
You know, roughly what, 2-3 feet high?
Yeah, maybe 2.5 feet high. It's about 20 inches across on the head, goat skin head pulled very tight by nylon rope.
And what are some of the fundamental sounds of it?
So, you know, the djembe really has three fundamental sounds. Mm-hmm. It's an hourglass-shaped drum, so the bottom or the foot is open. Mm-hmm. And that open foot allows it to have a very deep and resonant bass. So if I play that for you, you'll hear that a little bit.
Really deep.
Yeah, and you can get the resonance on it. It's very different than, say, a conga that even though the conga does have an open bottom, the egg shape of the drum isn't meant to resonate while the hourglass shape is.
Yeah.
There's two other sounds that are a part of the djembe's normal repertoire, the tone, which is played with pretty much the flat part of your fingers right on the edge. So it's a rounder sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then the slap, which is played with your fingertips with the heel of your hand butting up against the wood lip of the drum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot it's a loud crack, so hopefully their levels are okay. So
it's kind of like a rim shot.
A little bit, right? So you got bass, tone, slap.
Mm-hmm. And then as you lift the drum from the floor and open up that open bottom.
Right.
That's a major change in the
tone. So the djembe is almost never played flat on the ground, and you can hear that you would have almost no sound.
It's kind of a dead.
Right, and then as you lift it.
That's really a huge difference, isn't it?
It is.
So that becomes almost a source of melody in a sense.
It does, and in fact, maybe a little less so on a djembe, but a lot of drums, being able to play with the skin, the tautness of the skin by causing more pressure with another hand or blocking or unblocking the bottom is a huge part of how you play it.
And then the whole idea of polyrhythms is kind of, let's come up with a sort of capsule explanation of that.
Yeah, so, you know, this is how I explain it. I use the word polyrhythm, and I think that's what Western ethnomusicologists use. I think, however, if I was to explain it to a non-ethnomusicologist, I prefer the term multi-part music, only because the way that the aesthetic is, specifically I'm talking about West Africa, but a West African aesthetic for music sees the rhythm as one single rhythm with multiple people playing different parts. So, for example, one of the main accompaniment parts of rhythms that are have a strong 4-4 feeling. Is it okay if I play it on?
Sure, sure. Yeah.
So that would be a main accompaniment rhythm.
Right.
That rhythm alone actually has no name. There's no way to call that, even though I think in a Western sense we would say that that is a rhythm in itself. It is part of many other rhythms, and those rhythms have names. So in a West African sense, you have a rhythm, for example, a kasa. Kasa has two different djembe parts, at least. It has three different dundun parts. At least it might have a shaker, it might have bells. Each any one of those parts alone may not even be recognizable as kasa. It only really becomes kasa when all of those parts are played at the same time, which is why I think for most people that aren't studying this stuff, it's a lot easier to think about it as multi-part music. There's many parts that come together to make one rhythm.
It's much more complicated than most European music allows for, isn't it?
At least on the rhythmic side, definitely. The, the complexity of it and how the parts fit together, that you need to know your part really well, but also listen to it and hear it in the context of other parts.
Right.
It's not just you. It's you in the context of others. It's also a great metaphor for life.
Conma, this was your growing up, wasn't it?
This was me growing up. I definitely didn't have that many words, those many words to explain it, because it was just felt.
Well, who needs words when the music
you just
is
feel
going?
Right, but I understand when you're trying to get people to understand what we're doing. So that was my my childhood, a lot of African music. My mother's a singer, so I was around music a lot, and then I started singing because of her.
What are the songs saying?
A lot of the songs I grew up with, I left Africa when I was a little girl, so a lot of the songs were songs from my childhood, and my family was very Christian. So a lot of the songs are spiritual songs, just talking about, just asking for forgiveness, asking for love, asking for, you know, gratitude. A lot of them are more chanty than they are lyrically driven. So, it's, you know, I would repeat something over and over, and it's pretty much just saying, you know, please show us the way or make things clear or, you know, women, there's a woman who doesn't have a child and wants a child. Can you help her? You know, just like those kind of things. So I changed them around to fit, you know, where I am now in my life as far as, you know, how I see things. But they're all pretty much just based from those things in my childhood.
A lot of times when you have that sort of chant effect in the melody, it kind of becomes part of the whole overall percussion thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I started writing some songs recently, actually, in my language for the first time. And I've noticed that I write more to the drums than anything else. When I write songs, English songs, I write either to the bass or the guitar, but I write mostly with the drums when I'm writing.
Because you want to get that interaction.
Yeah, yeah. It's like you almost are part of the instrument. My voice become part of the rhythm somehow when I'm writing.
You know, the thing to me that's so exciting about polyrhythmic music is that you can sort of detect these different parts going on. There'll be different, you know, somebody's going 1, 2, 3, 4, somebody else is going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then they intersect at certain points.
And it all just makes sense when it comes together.
Well, it makes a lot more sense to the body than the mind, in a sense, right?
Right. Right. That's why you just feel. I mean, just being in Africa, I know so many African songs, but I don't know what they're saying because there's so many languages in Africa.
Yeah.
But you don't have to know. You just feel it.
Well, that's that whole thing about the unity of music and dance, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's not, you're not there to necessarily hear a verbal message. You're here to move your body.
Yeah. Become more in tune.
Become what?
Become more in tune with your surroundings, with the music, to where you get your own perspective on what's going on, not necessarily what somebody is saying, but you just concentrate on what you're feeling.
It can be kind of liberating.
Oh, it's very liberating. You should see me on stage.
She's liberated on stage.
I'm pretty liberated.
As a matter of fact, we will see you on stage.
Yes, please come out and see us on stage.
Thanks so much, Kanma. Kapono Chiati is the musical director, Kanma K, the lead vocalist for the band Jamarek, which performs in our Atherton studio this Saturday. And you can get details on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
When I cry, my mother goes carry me. She goes say, my PK, why till you let cry, yo, yo? Stop, stop. Stop, stop. Stop, stop. Make you don't cry again, yo.
A man with a criminal past wants to sell his Black Point home and give $200,000 of the profits to a foundation to build homes for the houseless. He hopes to get as much as $7 million for the property, but is that and the money for the donation realistic to accomplish his goal? Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider has a reality check. Hi, Anita.
Hi, Bethan. Aloha.
This is an interesting case. I mean, someone who appears to want to do something good for a cause that needs something done for it, but there's also this veneer of self, you know, servingness, if we can make that into a word, just, you know, something that's happening for his own aggrandizement. And that seems to not be sitting well with people. Also, just the fact that we're talking $200,000 and what can that do? How did all this come about?
That's right, Beth Ann. So in this case, this guy named Blake Tuck-Yoon, who lives in Kahala, wanted to sell his Kahala house and was looking for a way to market it. And it was in the process of doing that that he ended up deciding to start this new organization that hopes to help homeless families.
In helping homeless families, though, he's hoping to build what, maybe, you know, 300 little units, mini units, or duplexes. That can't be done with $200,000.
That's right. And what the foundation is going to need to do is to raise a lot more money to accomplish their goal. They're hoping to build a 300-home subdivision, and that's going to need a lot of donations to acquire the land and also to help make sure that there's enough infrastructure, as well as the amenities that they'd like to provide for the homeless families, which include a pool, a dog park, and even security guards.
Okay, so a couple of issues. Certainly nobody's going to sneeze at $200,000, but to really get this thing off the ground, there are those who are saying, okay, if you really want to do this and you really feel that passionately about it, why only give them $200,000? Why not give them $1 million or $2 million?
There definitely are those critical perspectives. You know, people are questioning whether it makes sense for somebody to sell a house and, you know, get so much profit from the house and give only this $200,000. But at the same time, you know, Mr. Yoon's business partners say that he doesn't need to give any money to charity at all, and he actually has really great intentions. And so there is that, those different perspectives.
I mean, clearly, again, when somebody's giving money, to look in their pocket is kind of tough, but this seems to have some other issues with it. We talked about a little bit in the opening about his criminal past, which was 25 years ago. Is there any real reason for keeping that in our faces?
I think that's debatable. You know, in this case, his criminal past is really no small matter. He actually went to federal prison for attempting to kill a man. He was a hired hitman back when he was 27 years old. That's when he was convicted. And so it's something that's really followed him throughout his life. And he says that it was decades ago and that he feels like a completely different person. But there are those who look at this and they say that they feel it's hard to have a hard time trusting somebody with, you know, that in their past.
That and the fact that he has some current need for some real cash because of his divorce situation.
Yes, he's undergone four bankruptcies and recently went through a divorce. And so he's having definitely that's part of the reason why he wants to sell his house. I should say that Mr. Yoon and his business partners say that they do have the best intentions and that what they really want to do is to help alleviate Hawaii's severe homelessness problem.
Well, as some might remind us, we know what path is paved with good intentions. Thanks a lot, Anita.
Thank you so much for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Anita Hofschneider. Mentally ill people often find that one of the revolving doors in their lives is the door to jail. Recent changes in the mental health staff at Oahu Community Correctional Center seem to be winnowing the services and the hours of service actually available. Dr. Mark Mitchell, formerly a mental health administrator at OCCC, is the latest to be let go in a string of contracts not renewed in recent years. So what is the obligation of public safety to mentally ill inmates? Kat Brady is the coordinator of the Community Alliance on Prisons. She joins us now. Hi there. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, this latest move by public safety has a context stemming from about a decade ago. And you were there advocating for inmates, certainly mentally ill inmates, back then when the Department of Justice turned their eyes on OCCC. Why did that happen?
Well, it's kind of interesting because around 2005 or 2006, I got a call from the Department of Justice from somebody who, an investigator in the Civil Rights Division, and he said, we're coming to Hawaii to look at mental health services in the correctional facilities. And I said, well, that'll be a short trip and a short report since we don't really have services. And he was shocked. And I told him I had just been at a meeting at the Department of Public Safety where the former director had actually said, this is a lawsuit waiting to happen.
You're talking about
not
Ted Sakai.
Not providing mental health treatment, Ted Sakai said, was a lawsuit waiting to happen. And then DOJ came in, but it was under the Bush administration, and Lingle was the governor. And, of course, our community mental health system kind of was diminished under that administration, and we're still trying to build it up. So right now, jails are being used as our de facto mental health centers, which the staff is not trained to do.
But when Dr. Mitchell came in, he did increase some of that staff and tried to create a little bit of order out of chaos.
Yes. He actually came in when the Department of Justice came out with their report, and he did an amazing thing because the department was totally in chaos in this area, and he really organized how to deliver good service to people who actually need it. And the number of people who actually make the cut for severe and persistent mental illness is about 17% statewide. He told me it's about 24% at the women's prison. And this we know, that women have higher levels of co-occurring disorders, depression and illegal drugs to stem their mental health problems. So we know that we have a huge gap of people who are diagnosed under DSM-5, but then there's another group that don't make that cut. that is really concerning to me, because this is really an Eighth Amendment violation. You know, it's how you treat people in prison. It's a constitutional issue.
So you're talking about the people who would be on sort of the edge of, yes, of mental illness as defined by the DSM-5.
Yeah, but they don't quite make that cut for serious.
Right, but I mean,
it's
like anything else, when you're right there at the edge, you're still at the edge, and you're saying with those people, which seem to be a larger population that we're not really looking toward, what will be the outcomes for those people when they cycle back out into society and then come back in? So what happens with those people? Do they not get any services now at all?
Minimal to none. And that is a huge problem, because it's a disproportionate number of the population. But even a severe and persistent mentally ill, I mean, there are people at OCCC that have the name like Jane Doe over the door because they don't know who they are. So what are we doing? Jail is not the place for somebody who is struggling with a mental health issue. So we should be looking at things as public health problems and criminal justice problems. When you have cancer, you don't go to a lawyer. You go to somebody who can treat that. And when you have substance abuse problems, jail is not the place that is going to help somebody overcome or recover.
Sometimes there are alternate avenues, though, to be able to get some of those outcomes. I mean, looking at your example, sometimes you do have to go to a lawyer potentially to be able to get relief from a particular organization, and that becomes your route to getting what you need to have happen. We've seen some of those convoluted ways happen also with public safety.
Yes.
What do you hear from Director Nolan Spinda?
Well, I guess what I found so disturbing was that he didn't feel that the diminishing of services, each person should be getting 20 hours of therapy a week. That has been reduced to 5. There are a number of vacancies. The legislature had allocated funding for 21 positions. Most of those positions are still vacant. So to have the director say that he doesn't see that it would be a problem, that there's really no, he said, I would hesitate to equate the number of vacancies with our ability to provide a safe, secure, and healthy environment. I don't know how somebody could say that when they know that people are in need of services and their services are cut to 25%. We know that people need, they need staff to help people, and we have vacancies. So how could that be true?
Going back to the context of all of this from over a decade ago when the Department of Justice began to put their eyes on Hawaii, clearly they still say that if they want to have more mental health services added to prisons and jails, not just OCCC.
Oh, yes.
So isn't this becoming a larger issue that Director Espinda is going to have to deal with regardless?
Oh, it's a huge issue, because that was part of the settlement, that they actually would expand mental health treatment to every facility in Hawaii. So, unfortunately, the Department of Public Safety has been consistent. Every time the feds come in and, you know, provide oversight and make recommendations, the department behaves. As soon as they leave, we go back to business as usual. So that's the consistency in the department, but not something to be proud of.
So what I hear you saying is, until there's another case that comes up that brings us back to the Department of Justice and potentially brings back federal oversight, you don't think that there's going to be much of any increase in services for people who are mentally ill and in jail?
No, I think when people speak truth to power, and the consequence for that is getting fired, that is a very clear message coming from the administration.
You're talking about Dr. Mitchell and others who have tried to raise the issue.
Yes. The medical director was fired last year. A psychiatric nurse left within the year. And they just let go Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Yee.
We have to wait and see how this is going to play out, but I can't imagine it's going to be necessarily a good thing for some of the people that you've been talking to.
No, we need to treat people like human beings.
Kat Brady, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kat Brady is a coordinator of the Community Alliance on Prisons and an advocate for social justice.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. We're tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's on tap this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. This week's Stargazers, Jupiter can be seen in the southwestern skies till it sets in the west around midnight. Saturn is also visible right through till the early morning. Our moon this week will be waning, meaning that by week's end, we can look forward to a return of star-filled dark skies here in the island.
There's an exciting space mission that has an event coming up tomorrow, and it also involves a team effort on Mauna Kea down here on Earth.
That's right. It may come as a surprise to some folks, but the backbone of any deep space mission to the outer planets are support observations made by ground-based telescopes here on Earth. The observatories of Gemini and Subaru atop Mauna Kea have been providing this mission-critical support to NASA's Juno spacecraft as it visits the mighty Jupiter. Last week saw some spectacular images of Jupiter taken by Gemini using their near-infrared imager. And tomorrow, as Juno prepares to perform another close flyby of Jupiter, both Gemini and Subaru will swing into action to image the giant planet.
And you would think that spacecraft would be doing all the work.
Yeah, we normally think of deep space probes using their cutting-edge sensors and images to provide all the important data. And to a degree, that's mostly true. But those sensors need targets, and ground-based observatories can provide a list of potential targets for space-based missions.
Provide some context to larger picture of what's happening.
Totally. It's great having a space probe in situ that's able to collect data, but awesome tools like Gemini's adaptive optic system can help add to the incredible data we receive.
And Subaru was able to image areas of Jupiter that the spacecraft wasn't able to, right?
Yes, Subaru was able to use an instrument called the Cooled Mid-Infrared Camera, or COMICS, which was able to image the Great Red Spot and the surrounding atmospheric features.
And how come the Juno couldn't do that?
Juno can do it, but its orbit takes it over a select path above the planet.
I get it. And so tomorrow, another big day. And this would be a big day for who? The NASA folks or the people here at Mauna Kea or just the spacecraft itself?
It's going to be a big day for everybody. In fact, Gemini is already taking data from Jupiter in the lead-up to tomorrow's flyby. This will help guide the science that Juno will have to perform as it soars over the turbulent atmosphere.
It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the NOAA Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remembered an artist born in Paris in 1898 whose works had a powerful impact on the local art scene and brought worldwide attention to the island's creative community. He had a lifelong commitment to folk art, especially the works he had seen in rural France and in Mexico. He came to Hawaii in 1949 and soon immersed himself in local language and culture, eventually writing plays in both Hawaiian and English. He was an amazingly versatile artist who created hundreds of paintings, lithographs, murals, works of sculpture, and wrote art criticism for both of Honolulu's daily newspapers. In 1968, a foundation was created in his name whose stated purpose was development of interest in the arts, encouragement of artists, and study of art. In 1976, the Hawaii State Legislature presented him with the Order of Distinction for Cultural Leadership. He was known as Palani to his Hawaiian friends, but he was born Jean Charlot.
And we had a call from Connie Ditchner, who knew the right answer, and we'll be receiving our great tote bag to let everyone else know you got it right. Now, if you've got a question for us, you can always send it in to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Hi, I'm Sean Anderson from Green Rose Farm. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
You can't have a beehive without drones, and many an office worker has felt like one, a disposable, easily replaceable member of the hive. That's why the 1980 movie 9 to 5 hit a chord with so many when it came out, and why its story lives on as a stage musical, enlivened with songs by original cast member Dolly Parton. Kalani Whitford is directing the Maui Onstage production, and he's on the phone with us now. Hi, Kalani.
Hi, Chris.
You know, I was thinking about this show and about the movie that spawned it. There aren't many people who can't identify with the whole thing of the bored office worker who doesn't get much input into what goes on. Do you think that's true?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because most people work some kind of a job, whether it is 9 to 5 or 8 to 4, 10 to 3, whatever it is, everybody has to go in and be responsible to someone else. And yeah, it's a very familiar story, I think.
When you tell people that you're doing this show, do they comment accordingly? Say, oh God, that reminds me of a job I had right out of college or whatever.
I've had a few of those. Yeah.
Well, how does it play out in the story of the show?
Well, the musical sticks really quite closely to the film. I mean, obviously there's songs that Dolly wrote and added, but the story is very, very close. And in fact, a lot of the dialogue is taken just straight from the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see why, can't you?
Yeah. It's I went back and watched the film a bunch of times over the last few months to prepare for this, and it just still stands up to this day, the writing, the acting. The look of it is funny now because of, we're looking back at 1980, and so hair and makeup and clothes.
Sure.
Is funny, but the story itself is very still pertinent today.
In putting together the stage production, did you, were the things that you felt the need to update, or did it, were you able to kind of leave it the way it was presented?
No, we left it the way it was, and the fun thing for us was to try to find typewriters from 1980, all this office equipment from 1980, all of that stuff, the clothes, and we've got great wigs for the women, and yeah, it's that's been the really fun part.
Well, I mean, you couldn't do a Dolly Parton show without some wigs, could you?
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, but it also was a reminder that in the office of 1980, there was no such thing as a computer, was there?
Right. Yeah, there wasn't. And we've been able to find these enormous typewriters. There were a few of the, younger 18, 19-year-olds that we sort of had to show them how to use them, shall we say.
Yeah, because I—that's right. For somebody 20 years old, it's probably unimaginable what an office was like in those days.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, one of the themes that I remember so much from the movie is that whole thing that you have in an office of feeling that you really don't have any part in decisions that are made. You know, a bad decision can be made. There's nothing you can do about it, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of what leads to that whole thing of the, you know, the Dolly Parton character and her friends. Kind of one of the arcs of the whole thing is they're gaining more control, isn't it?
Yeah, that they keep having to do all the work for the boss, and they keep getting treated in such a terrible way, even though they're really the ones running the office, and they just get so fed up with it that they finally decide to kidnap him and take over. They stand up for themselves and each other, the whole office. Yeah, it's great.
There's a sort of a delicate balance in the storytelling, I would think, anyway, because it's still a comedy, but yet you have a villain, but he kind of can't be too evil, can he?
It's a balance, because you want Franklin Hart, the boss, you want him to be evil enough so that when the girls kidnap him, that the audience is on their side.
Right.
But yeah, you don't want him to be too evil. It's something we've been working on to strike that balance of kind of evil. And also, in this show and at that period, there was a little more misogyny and just open misogyny and the oppression of women. And so we've been trying to kind of balance that out in the beginning, the first half, so that we're on their side when they finally stand up against him.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, 1980. Well, you know, I mean, you could argue that things have changed in the workplace since 1980, but a lot of that 1980 vibe, the whole idea that women of any age are the girls, that still persists, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's still, unfortunately, relevant today.
How young are some of the younger members of the cast? I'm just curious how they view this whole story.
We've got a few that are 18, 19, and then maybe 5 or 6 that are under 25, and then most, maybe a dozen people are sort of in their 30s, mm-hmm. 40s, and then we've got a handful that are, you know, a little older than 40. In their 50s. But so most of the cast does remember this period. Most of us were alive and remember.
Sure. Well, I'm just wondering, Kalani, if you know, you had to sort of take some time with the younger members to kind of explain what must have seemed like a very different world to them.
Yeah, we've tried to. And of course, they can... instantly get on their phones, and probably faster than we can explain it, look things up, and you know, so
sure.
It's a bit of both.
Have you been able to get things to move along? You know, pacing is so important in comedy. Have you got things moving along pretty briskly, you feel, for this show?
Yeah, we do. That's something I was really concerned with, was pacing, because what can happen sometimes when you're taking a script that started out as a film that then becomes a stage play is, in film, they can jump from one location to another in half a second. But for stage, a lot of stuff has to go on and off, and it can take a long time. So the set that Kara Walker designed, our set designer, is a really something to see set, because she solved that problem in a really ingenious way.
Well, that's good. That is an important thing. And good luck with the show, Kalani.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking with us. Kalani Whitford is the director of the Maui On Stage production of the stage musical 9 to 5 that runs on weekends at the Iao Theater in Wailuku through August 6th. There's always a lot going on around our state of Hawaii, and Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama keeps track of events going on in our community that are a little under the radar. Today, there's a lot going on, including an event at the Hawaii Volcano Observatory.
Yes, it's happening tomorrow. The Volcano Observatory, as many people know, has evolved as technologies evolve, as we all have. It's a challenge is to apply today's digital techniques to seismic records that were kept on paper in the last century. And geophysicist Paul Okubo will take a look into seismograms from the observatory's first 100 years. And this talk is tomorrow in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium at 7, and it's free with admission to Hawaii Volcanoes National Park.
And that's the place to do it. It's the longest continued eruption in recorded history at Kilauea.
Yeah.
And the Marine Corps Pacific Band, these are this is a band I know a little bit about. They're terrific.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They'll be performing tomorrow at the Ala Moana Center stage from 5 to 6 p.m. Variety of music, jazz-inspired works, folk tunes, marches, classics, you know, all that stuff.
That's at Ala Moana, 5 to 6?
Yes.
And the Hawaii Performing Arts Festival is ongoing.
Yes, it actually runs until July 24th. There's a concert tomorrow called A Grand Night in Vienna, and the festival orchestra will perform Beethoven's Second Symphony and more. It's in HPA's Gates Performing Arts Center in Waimea at 7 p.m. tomorrow night. For ticket information, please go to our website.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more about those events at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
With that, we're going to be coming up to the top of the hour and time for us to say goodbye. Now, Net Neutrality Day is this Wednesday. Tomorrow, we'll talk with Chris Conybeare, president of the Media Council, and we'll find out what's happening locally.
And construction is well underway for a groundbreaking tiny house project on Kauai.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org to leave us your comments, or you can post them on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you tomorrow with more of The Conversation.